Isaiah, chapters 41 and 42. The 27th talk in a series on Isaiah was presented by David Crabtree on March 23, 2014 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved.
Okay, we'll be looking at chapters 41 and 42 of Isaiah. As I mentioned last week, chapter 40 marks a new section in Isaiah. Things change rather dramatically. We move from an emphasis on the condemnation of Judah and Israel for their sins with some encouragement sprinkled in. Now it's going to be mostly encouragement with some condemnation sprinkled in, but there's a significant change in tone, which is why many scholars want to make a distinction between first Isaiah and second Isaiah. And in the last chapter, there were three main points that are made. The first is that human beings are ephemeral, and that even the biggest and strongest empire is but frail grass before God. The second is that God is the creator and the master of history, and therefore the word of God stands forever, is what it says. And the third is that God is and will continue to be the source of strength for his people. Now, as we proceed, these next few chapters are just going to build on those same themes in various ways. Chapter 41, we'll read the first section. Coastlands, listen to me in silence, and let the peoples gain new strength. Let them come forward then, let them speak. Let them come together for judgment. Who has aroused one from the east, whom he calls in righteousness to his feet? He delivers up nations before him and subdues kings. He makes them like dust with his sword, as the wind-driven chaff with his bow. He pursues them, passing on in safety, by a way he had not been, traversing with his feet. Who has performed and accomplished it, calling forth the generations from the beginning? I, the Lord, am the first, and with the last, I am he. So this begins with God calling the coastlands, and the coastlands means the furthest extents of civilization. So it's calling the peoples from all over the world, listen to me in silence, and the silence here is reverence. Come before me in reverence. The peoples gain new strength, and I think it's strength to stand before the God Almighty. And then he encourages them to interact with him. We've seen this kind of phrase earlier, in much earlier in Isaiah. He says, let them come forward, then let them speak. Let us come together for judgment. And I think the idea is, let them come and let us reason through this. We've seen that earlier in Isaiah when Isaiah was speaking to Judah and Jerusalem in particular. And he said, come, let us reason together. In other words, let's think about this. Let's sort this out. Then he starts talking about this. He's reasoning through this issue. How should you, the peoples of the world, how should you think about and relate to me? He says who has aroused one from the east. Now it's a little bit of a puzzle to figure out who this is that's being aroused from the east. The church fathers, many of the church fathers and some of the medieval theologians took this to be Abraham, that it's Abraham that's being called from the east. And they're primarily taking that from the next phrase where it says, whom he calls in righteousness to his feet. Well, who's righteous? Who's in the east? The two clues seem to point to Abraham, is the thinking. But when it says, whom he calls in righteousness, that could be translated differently. It could be whom he calls in the service of righteousness. If that is indeed the better interpretation, then it's whom he calls to set things right, to right things. And if that's the case, then a better candidate seems to be Cyrus the Persian. And there's going to be, in this section, it's going to shift from what Isaiah was focusing on earlier, was the coming invasion of the Assyrians. And now the backdrop seems to be the exile and then the return from exile. And so Cyrus would be much more fitting in this particular context. So I'm inclined to think that the one from the east is Cyrus. Now, just to remind you, the chronology here, the order of events, is that the Assyrians are the ones we've been talking about for the last 39 chapters. The Assyrians rose up, and that was what was so scary to the people of Judah, that it looked like Assyria was going to get its act together and come to the west and attack them. Assyria does that. And Assyria ends up taking the northern kingdom into exile, and Assyria comes and surrounds Jerusalem, besieges it, but then leaves overnight. All of that was talked about in the first 39 chapters. And then Assyria is not really a threat to Palestine, for it ceases to be a threat ever to them. The next power to come along are the Babylonians. And the Babylonians conquer the Assyrians, and they take over that area and build a bigger empire than had the Assyrians constructed. The Babylonians then are going to come west, and they will conquer Judah and take the people of Judah, the leading people in their society, and take them in exile to Babylon. Then the Babylonians will be overthrown by the Persians, and it is under the Persians then that the Jews in Babylon will be allowed to come back to Israel and rebuild Jerusalem. And the ruler of Persia that issues that decree that sends them back home is Cyrus. So that would fits with what we have here. Cyrus then is the one to whom God delivers up the nations before him, and who subdues the kings before him. He clears the way for Cyrus and his conquests. And it is Cyrus's sword then that makes the other nations as dust, mincing them finely, apparently, and as wind-driven chaff with his bow. So they just disperse, they become non-entities before his power and might. And Cyrus, in pursuing them, is going to go along paths that where he has not been, and yet he will pursue them in safety. God obviously preparing the way and making that possible. So then God says, who has performed it and accomplished it, calling forth the generations from the beginning? A rhetorical question. It is God who has done all of these things. Clearly God's hand is behind all of these things that have happened, because they fulfill the prophecies that had been issued years earlier. In fact, if we take Isaiah to all have been written by Isaiah, then what is written here in chapter 41 was written about 150 years before Cyrus comes on the scene. So this is predicting those events, and then in advance declaring that God did all those things. Calling forth the generations from the beginning. So from the beginning of time, God has called forth the generations to do his bidding, to construct history in the way that it has been constructed. And then he concludes the section, I, the Lord, am the first with the last. I am he. Now these are words that you might remember from Revelation. Similar wording appears there. Also, similar wording appears in John, where Jesus uses the phrase in 8:58 in speaking to the Jews. Well, I'll read 57. The Jews therefore said to him, "You are not yet 50 years old, and have you seen Abraham?" Jesus said to them, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am." And if he is hearkening back to Isaiah, then he's making what they would consider a blasphemous claim. That's a profound claim that he's making. Next section. The coastlands have seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. They have drawn near and have come. Each one helps his neighbor and says to his brother, "Be strong." So the craftsman encourages the smelter, and he who smooths metal with the hammer encourages him who beats the anvil, saying of the soldering, "It is good." And he fastens it with nails that it should not totter. This is the response to God and his activity. In particular, here the context is with Cyrus coming. But this is their response. They're fearful. The coastlands have seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. So they're afraid. What do? They go into action, building for themselves idols. Idols that will protect them. We've seen a very similar passage in the last chapter where it uses this as well in verses 18 through 20, where it talks about an idol being built. And I think in both cases, it's the same point is being made, that we have a number of master craftsmen who are all contributing to this effort. So this is some of the most capable people that they have are working together to build an idol that will help them, will provide them security in the face of this threat. And in both cases, it ends with the same phrase, that it should not totter. So they're building this, they're using their best skill to build this idol, but there's still the chance it would just fall over. It's a man-made thing, after all. When it comes down to it, it's just a man-made thing. And it cannot provide the kind of security that they are hoping for. And it's interesting, it says, and each one helps his neighbor and says to his brother, "Be strong." So they're encouraging each other to be strong in the making of this idol. And strength is the issue here. That is, how are they going to be strong? And that comes up in the next section. Verse 8, "But you, Israel, my servant, Jacob, whom I have chosen, descendant of Abraham, my friend, you whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its remotest parts and said to you, 'You are my servant. I have chosen you and not rejected you.' Do not fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Surely I will help you. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Behold, all those who are angered at you will be shamed and dishonored. Those who contend with you will be as nothing and will perish. You will seek those who quarrel with you, but will not find them. Those who war with you will be as nothing and non-existent. For I am the Lord your God who upholds your right hand, who says to you, 'Do not fear, I will help you.'" So this is his encouragement to the people of Israel. The Gentiles are scrambling around trying to build idols that will provide security for them. But he turns to Israel. He says, "My servant." And that's going to be significant as we move on here. But just remember here that he's referring to the nation of Israel as "my servant." He says, whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called from its remotest parts. So it's talking about some kind of gathering of Jews that are being brought from all over the world, and they are together God's servant, the servant that God has chosen and has not rejected. So we seem to be talking about, and presumably this is the return from the exile, at least on the short run. On the long run, And ultimately, I think it's talking about the bringing together of his people in the end of time. What he says to them is, don't fear, for I am with you. Do not anxiously look about you, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. So here is a God who actually provides strength and security. It's not just coming from each other, encouraging one another as best they can. Surely I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. So he's going to strengthen and uphold them in righteousness, setting things right. And their enemies are going to disappear. All those who are angered at you will be shamed and dishonored. Those who contend with you will be as nothing and will perish. You'll look for those who quarrel with you, but you won't find them. Those who war with you are going to disappear. All of their opposition is going to be gone. All of their enemies will cease to exist. For I am the Lord your God who upholds your right hand. Do not fear, I will help you. Next section. Do not fear, you worm Jacob, you men of Israel. I will help you, declares the Lord, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. Behold, I have made you a new sharp threshing sledge with double edges. You will thresh the mountains and pulverize them, and will make the hills like chaff. You will winnow them, and the wind will carry them away, and the storm will scatter them. But you will rejoice in the Lord. You will glory in the Holy One of Israel. Do not fear, you worm Jacob. Worm has to be a term of affection here. What it seems to be, we've got you worm Jacob, and it's you men of Israel. The point seems to be you who are merely mortal. You who are merely mortal and relatively weak and insignificant. But nevertheless, even though that's true of you, nevertheless, don't fear. Because God says, I will help you. He says, declares the Lord, and your Redeemer is the Holy One of Israel. This phrase, Holy One of Israel, occurs quite a number of times in Isaiah and seems to be a quite elevated term for God. Then he uses an image. He likens the nation of Israel with God's shaping them into a threshing sledge with double edges. And what are they going to thresh? They're going to thresh the mountains. Now, I don't know exactly how that works, but this threshing sledge is apparently something that's that comes along with blades, and it is going to just take out the mountains. Now, that's significant because we saw in the previous chapter, verses 3 and 4 of chapter 40, a voice is calling, clear the way for the Lord in the wilderness. Make smooth in the desert a highway for our God. Let every valley be lifted up, and every mountain and hill be made low. And let the rough ground become a plain, and the rugged terrain a broad valley. So the nation of Israel then is being given this task of creating a highway for the God, for God to come. And this, so that image I think is being drawn upon here. This threshing sledge is going to be the instrument by which the mountains are brought down and pulverized and the hills are made like chaff. And you will winnow them and the wind will carry them away. So those obstacles to God's coming are going to be reduced to just dust and chaff, and they'll just blow away. Next section. The afflicted and needy are seeking water, but there is none, and their tongue is parched with thirst. I, the Lord, will answer them myself. As the God of Israel, I will not forsake them. I will open rivers on the bare heights and springs in the midst of the valleys. I will make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land foundations of water. I will put the cedar in the wilderness, the acacia and the myrtle and the olive tree. I will place the juniper in the desert together with the box tree and the cypress, that they may see and recognize and consider and gain insight as well, that the hand of the Lord has done this, and the Holy One of Israel has created it. So the afflicted and the needy here, he's used this term before and he's used other similar terms. And I think I'm now convinced that he's using these as images for the spiritual condition of one. That is, the spiritually thirsty, the spiritually needy. They are afflicted and needy, seeking water, but there is none. So they really want to be satisfied spiritually, be fulfilled spiritually. And God is the one who's going to respond to that need. And he's going to respond to that need by bringing water everywhere, even to the driest places. We're going to have an abundance of water. There will be open rivers on the bare heights, springs in the valleys. There will be pools of water in the wilderness, and there will be fountains of water on the dry land. Furthermore, as a result of this abundance of moisture in a dry land, now there are going to be trees growing. It'll be forest-like rather than desert and wilderness. We're going to have all kinds of trees growing, cedar, acacia, myrtle, olive tree, juniper, box tree, and cypress. Why is God doing this? It's so that people can see. God is going to act in a way that people can see and recognize and consider and gain insight as well, that the hand of the Lord has done this. And the Holy One of Israel has created it. Created harkens back to Genesis, where he was the creator. Well, here's another aspect of his creation. Now, let me take just a minute and explain how I'm looking at this. And it's been as a result of looking at the book of Matthew that I have kind of tumbled onto this. I think what's happening in Isaiah is there are certain symbols that are being used that are talking about, are primarily being used to capture some kind of spiritual reality. So here we've got people who are needy and afflicted and seeking water. Well, I think that's an image, someone who's thirsty, extremely thirsty, who's desperate for water, but that's an image that's intended to capture this concept of someone who really wants spiritual fulfillment, really wants things to be set right, righteousness. Elsewhere, and we'll see it continues, Isaiah likes to use the image of blindness. And he uses blindness to be something that's broken, something that's not the way it ought to be. He uses deafness as well. So the blind and the deaf, it's something that needs to be fixed. And I noticed I'm in the process of writing an article for News and Views, but I was looking in Matthew at a strange little incident, I think, where John the Baptist has just been put in prison. At the end of his ministry, he's about to be executed, and he probably knew that execution was imminent when he was put in prison. And he sends his disciples to Jesus to ask, "Are you the one, or should we be looking for another?" Very interesting, because if anybody had good reason to think that Jesus was the Messiah, it should have been John the Baptist. He had a lot of information about his cousin, Jesus, all of it pointing to him being the Messiah. John himself was given a mission to pave the way for the Messiah, and yet he's in prison and he's thinking, it's not working out right. This doesn't seem to be fitting all the clues. I'm not sure that Jesus is really the one. And Jesus' response is, he tells the disciples of John that were sent to him to report back what they see and what they hear. Then he says something further, Matthew 11. Let me read you I'll start with verse 2. "Now when John in prison heard of the works of Christ, he sent word by his disciples and said to him, 'Are you the expected one, or shall we look for someone else?' And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Go and report to John what you hear and see. The blind receive sight, and the lame walk. The lepers are cleansed, and the deaf hear. And the dead are raised up, and the poor have the gospel preached to them. And blessed is he who keeps from stumbling over me.'" So he says to the disciples of John, go and report to John what you hear and see. And then he tells them what they'll see and hear. And it's the blind receive sight, and the lame walk, etc. That section there, verse 5, is not a quotation from the Old Testament. It's just taking a bunch of images from the Old Testament and lumping them together. The first phrase, the blind receive sight, seems to be directly from the book of Isaiah. And the last one, the poor have the gospel preached to them, appears to be directly from Isaiah. I think what Jesus is doing there is not quoting Isaiah as much as he is alluding to Isaiah. And what he's alluding to in Isaiah is all of this talk of these images of the blind being given sight, the deaf being made to hear, the lame being made to walk. And those themes show up a number of times in Isaiah, and it's that which is broken being fixed. And I think what Jesus is saying is, I have performed a number of miracles that are not just shows of power. They are acts in which I have taken that which is broken and I have fixed it. I've made it right. That's what righteousness is being made right, being made the way that God intended it. And so what Jesus is saying is, I have performed some works which are physical metaphors for precisely the thing that the Messiah will come to do, that Isaiah predicted that the Messiah would come to do. So his point is, John, go back and look at Isaiah. Reread Isaiah and all that it says about the time, what the Messiah is going to accomplish, what the kingdom will be like that the Messiah brings in. And it will be a time when things that are broken are fixed. And I have performed works which you can look at and other people can look at, and it's taken broken things and fixed them. But that's not ultimately the broken stuff that's important that the Messiah is going to fix. That's a spiritual matter, but that's hard to see. But the miracles can be seen by anyone. So they serve then as kind of what I think of as a physical metaphor for what the Messiah was to do. And Jesus is saying, and I have done that. That is a down payment on what I as the Messiah have come to do. Similarly, I think here in Isaiah 41, in these verses, there is both a physical reality here as well as a spiritual reality. That is, God will provide fulfillment for the spiritually thirsty. But I suspect there's a physical metaphor behind it as well, that there will be water in dry places. There will be trees that will grow up in dry and arid areas. And that is going to be the physical metaphor that points to what God will ultimately do. Okay. I hope it was possible to follow that. Next section. Present your case, the Lord says. Bring forward your strong arguments, the King of Jacob says. Let them bring forth and declare to us what is going to take place. As for the former events, declare what they were, that we may consider them and know their outcome. Or announce to us what is coming. Declare the things that are going to come afterward, that we may know that you are God's. Indeed, do good or evil, that we may anxiously look about us and fear together. Behold, you are of no account, and your work amounts to nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. In verse 21, when he says, present your case, he is apparently speaking to his competitors, that is, rival gods, whether they're the gods of Assyria, the gods of Babylon, or whatever they are. And he's saying, you who are pretenders to my position as God, you come forth and make your case as to why you should be treated with reverence and fear. He says, bring forth your strong arguments, the King of Jacob says, the King of Jacob. So he's identifying himself with, he's the King of Israel. He's the one who spoke to Abraham. He's the God of Israel. And the challenge, he throws down the gauntlet and he says, you tell us what's going to happen. And you tell us what has happened and what the results are of those things. You take history and you make a coherent whole out of it. You predict the future in a way, and then you bring it to pass. That's his challenge to the rival gods. He says in 23, declare the things that are going to come afterward that we may know that you are gods. In fact, he goes on with an even greater taunt. He says, indeed, do good or evil that we may anxiously look about us and fear together. In other words, do anything, act, and demonstrate that you are a power to be reckoned with. But in fact, he says, you are of no account, and your work amounts to nothing. He who chooses you is an abomination. Next section. I have aroused one from the north, and he has come. From the rising of the sun, he will call on my name, and he will come upon rulers as upon mortar, even as the potter treads clay. Who has declared this from the beginning that we might know, or from former times that we may say he is right? Surely there was no one who declared. Surely there was no one who proclaimed. Surely there was no one who heard your words. Formerly I said to Zion, behold, here they are. And to Jerusalem, I will give a messenger of good news. But when I look, there is no one, and there is no counselor among them who, if I ask, can give an answer. Behold, all of them are false. All their works are worthless. Their molten images are wind and emptiness. Verse 25, I have aroused one coming from the north, and he has come. Isaiah could have made this easier to understand. But I think that he has to be talking again about Cyrus. Cyrus would have come from the east, and if I'm right, that's how he was referred to earlier, who has aroused one from the east in verse 2. But now it describes him as coming from the north. Well, Cyrus did originate from the east, but as an invader, he's going to have to come from the north. So it would be possible for the same person to both come from the east and come from the north. And I assume that that's what he means here. And it says, from the rising of the sun, he will call on my name, and he will come upon rulers as upon mortar. It is a little tricky here. He will call upon my name, because usually to call upon my name indicates looking to God for one's salvation. We don't know for sure where Cyrus was spiritually, but it is interesting what it says at the beginning of the book of Ezra. I'll just read the first, three verses. Now in the first year of Cyrus, king of Persia, in order to fulfill the word of the Lord by the mouth of Jeremiah, the Lord stirred up the spirit of Cyrus, king of Persia, so that he sent a proclamation throughout all his kingdom, and also put it in writing, saying, thus says Cyrus, king of Persia, the Lord, the God of heaven, has given me all the kingdoms of the earth, and he has appointed me to build him a house in Jerusalem, which is in Judah. Whoever there is among you of all his people, may his God be with him. Let him go up to Jerusalem, which is in Judah, and rebuild the house of the Lord, the God of Israel. He is the God who is in Jerusalem, etc. It's hard to know what Cyrus was actually thinking when he pronounced these words. Is there a responsiveness to God that's indicated here or not? I don't know for sure. But that's either what has happened or something else is meant here in verse 25 when it says, he will call on my name. Something short of looking to God as his Savior and Lord. He will come upon rulers as upon mortar, even as a potter treads clay. He's just going to stomp on all the opposition in front of him. So then, that's what's happening. That's what God has done. Now, who has declared this from the beginning that we might know? So who's predicted this? Who said that this is going to happen? Or from former times that we may say he is right. He says, surely no one has declared it, no one has proclaimed it, and there was no one who heard your words. In 27, but I sent spokesmen, and formerly I said to Zion, behold, here they are. So I don't know whether the they is the prophets or whether it's the words. And to Jerusalem, I will give a messenger of good news. There it's a messenger. There it's a prophet. But when he looks at the other gods, they have done nothing similar. They have done nothing comparable. When I look, there is no one. There is no counselor among that. So I think counselor here in the idea of a spokesman for the God, who, if I ask, can give an answer. They haven't done anything comparable. They haven't told you what lies ahead in the future and made it come to pass. So all of them are false. Their works are worthless. Their molten images are wind and emptiness. Next chapter. Now, then this next chapter, 42, is the first of four what are called servant songs. And we'll see the other four in the next 12 chapters. And these are all kind of self-contained. Each one is kind of self-contained, and we'll have to look at each one and figure out what's going on in them. Starting with verse 1. Behold, my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I have put my spirit upon him. He will bring forth justice to the nations. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break, and a dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. He will faithfully bring forth justice. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice in the earth, and the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law. Now the question is, who is this servant? The medieval Jewish interpreters of the Old Testament consistently interpreted this servant to be the nation of Israel. And they do that because of what we saw in chapter 41, where it refers to Israel as my servant. So their assumption is, wherever we see my servant, it is talking about the nation of Israel as a whole, not talking about the Messiah. But there were even some ancient Jewish interpreters who took this to be a reference to the Messiah. And this passage is cited in Matthew and one of the other Gospels in reference to Jesus specifically. That my servant here is, this passage is fulfilled in Jesus and his coming. The very first phrase here, behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights, I have put my spirit upon him, is very reminiscent of wording that's used when Jesus is baptized. So this seems to be a reference to the Messiah, to Jesus, that Jesus is coming as God's servant with God's spirit put upon him, and he is going to bring justice to the nations. That's his assignment. Now we see an interesting characterization in verse 2. He will not cry out or raise his voice, nor make his voice heard in the street. He's not loud. And I'm not sure exactly what it all is behind that. He's gentle, soft-spoken, not ostentatious. I'm not sure exactly what the connotation is here. But there's a gentleness to him. Verse 3, another kind of gentleness. A bruised reed he will not break. A bruised reed is easy to break. It's already fractured. A dimly burning wick he will not extinguish. So we've got a wick that's probably at the end and easy to put out, and he won't do that. He doesn't trample the fragile. He's gentle with the fragile. So that's the nature of this servant. And he will be persistent. He will not be disheartened or crushed until he has established justice throughout the world. And the coastlands will wait expectantly for his law, or it could be his instruction. They'll want to hear what he has to say and respond to it. The next section. Thus says God the Lord, who created the heavens and stretched them out, who spread out the earth and its offspring, who gives breath to the people on it and spirit to those who walk in it. I am the Lord. I have called you in righteousness. I will also hold you by the hand and watch over you. And I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations, to open blind eyes, to bring out prisoners from the dungeon, and those who dwell in darkness from the prison. I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another, nor my praise to graven images. Behold, the former things have come to pass, now I declare new things. Before they spring forth, I proclaim them to you. So God says, I'm the Lord, I'm the one who has called you my servant in righteousness. I'll watch over you, and I will appoint you as a covenant to the people, as a light to the nations. I'm not sure whether this means a covenant to the people means a covenant to the Jews and a light to the nations, so it's saying two different things, or is this saying the same thing, that is, a covenant to the people all over the world and a light to the nations, saying essentially the same thing. And I'm not sure which that is. I've gone back and forth on that. The thing that's difficult here is the word people here in the Hebrew does not have the article. If it had the article, I would be quite confident that that was referring to Israel. But it does not have the article. So it could be that it's just saying the same thing in both lines, which is to bring light, enlightenment to the people of the world. But he will come to open blind eyes. I talked about that earlier. I think that is a physical image of what God is going to do. To bring out prisoners from the dungeon. Again, I think a physical metaphor. I am the Lord, that is my name. I will not give my glory to another, nor my praise to graven images. So God is the one who has done this, and he's not going to allow any competitor to have this kind of claim to being in control of things. Verse 9, behold, the former things have come to pass. Now I declare new things. Before they spring forth, I proclaim them to you. He is the master of history. He's the one directing history, and he alone. Okay, at this point, in response to that, it prompts a song of praise to God, starting with verse 10. Sing to the Lord a new song. Sing his praise from the end of the earth. You who go down to the sea and all that is in it, you islands and those who dwell on them, let the wilderness and its cities lift up their voices. The settlements where Kedar inhabits, let the inhabitants of Selah sing aloud. Let them shout for joy from the tops of the mountains. Let them give glory to the Lord and declare his praise in the coastlands. The Lord will go forth like a warrior. He will arouse his zeal like a man of war. He will utter a shout. Yes, he will raise a war cry. He will prevail against his enemies. So here's a song, and it's encouraging everybody to join in. Those who are down by the sea, those who are in the islands, those who are in the wilderness, those who are in the cities, the settlements where Kedar inhabits, that's in the desert. Let the inhabitants of Selah sing. Selah seems to be Petra. Both of those are communities in the desert area. Let them shout for joy from the tops of the mountains. So all over the world, let them shout for joy and give glory to the Lord, because God is coming forth like a warrior, and he is going to thoroughly trounce his enemies. Next section. I have kept silent for a long time. I have kept still and restrained myself. Now, like a woman in labor, I will groan. I will both gasp and pant. I will lay waste the mountains and hills and wither all their vegetation. I will make the rivers into coastlands and dry up the ponds. And I will lead the blind by a way they do not know. In paths they do not know, I will guide them. I will make darkness into light before them, and rugged places into plains. These are the things I will do, and I will not leave them undone. They shall be turned back and be utterly put to shame, who trust in idols, who who say to molten images, you are our gods. So he's using the image here of a woman who is about to give birth, a woman who's gone into labor. He's used this image several times. I can think of at least two in Isaiah previous to this. But in those times, he used this image to describe a situation in which there was a lot of work happening, but then usually it ended in giving birth to wind, that nothing really results from it. A lot of activity, but no results. Here he's using the image differently. Here, the woman in labor is someone who cannot any longer restrain herself. She is crying out and probably active, doing the work of giving birth. And it is God that is likened to this. God has reached the place where he cannot be silent any longer. He can't wait any longer. He has got to act and to cry out. And when he does that, what does he do? He lays waste the mountains and hills. He withers all their vegetation. He makes the rivers into coastlands and dries up the ponds. So he torches the place. Then he will lead the blind by a way they do not know. And I think the blind here has a little bit different connotation than what we've seen before. It's the ones who can't do it for themselves. They can't find their way by themselves. And God is going to lead them. And he's going to take them on paths they don't know. They are completely unfamiliar. They haven't learned that route. And he's going to make the darkness into light before them and rugged places into plains. He's going to smooth the way for them and remove all of the obstacles. That's what he's going to do, and he won't leave any of this undone. And in the light of this, anyone who has turned to the idols and put their trust in the idols, they will be put to shame. Next section. Hear, you deaf, and look, you blind, that you may see. Who is blind but my servant, or so deaf as my messenger whom I send? Who is so blind as he that is at peace with me, or so blind as the servant of the Lord? You have seen many things, but you do not observe them. Your ears are open, but none hears. The Lord was pleased for his righteousness' sake to make the law great and glorious. But this is a people plundered and despoiled. All of them are trapped in caves or are hidden away in prisons. They have become a prey with none to deliver them, and a spoil with none to say, give them back. Okay, this gets tricky because we have another reference to my servant. But it seems to be talking about Israel here, the nation of Israel. So I think what's going on is now we've reverted back to my servant referring to Israel as it did in chapter 41, verse 8. So Isaiah is going back and forth. Sometimes his servant is the Messiah, and sometimes his servant is the nation of Israel. That's the only way I can put this together. I think that must be what's happening. So, hear, you deaf, and look, you blind, that you may see. Who is blind but my servant, or so deaf as my messenger whom I send? Who is so blind as he that is at peace with me, is what my translation says, but that could be translated, who is he that is devoted to me? Who is he that is set aside for me, I think is the notion here. Or so blind as the servant of the Lord. Then he goes on, you've seen things, but you didn't observe them. Your ears are open, but none hears. So, God, for his righteousness' sake, he made the law great and glorious. And I think he gave a great and glorious law to this people. But because of the way they responded to that law, this is a people plundered and despised. Spoiled. All of them are trapped in caves or are hidden away in prisons. They have become a prey with none to deliver them and a spoil with none to say, give them back. That is their state. Okay, the last few verses. Who among you will give ear to this? Who will give heed and listen hereafter? Who gave Jacob up for spoil and Israel to plunderers? Was it not the Lord against whom we have sinned, and whose ways they were not willing to walk, and whose law they did not obey? So he poured out on him the heat of his anger and the fierceness of battle, and it set him aflame all around, yet he did not recognize it, and it burned him, but he paid no attention. So God is saying, listen, listen if you will. Who is the one who turned Israel over to its plunderers and its pillagers? It was God himself who did that. The author of history did that. Because it was against him that Israel had sinned, and it was his law that they did not obey. So God poured out his anger on them, set them on fire, but they didn't even recognize it. They didn't even understand that that is what had happened. Okay. The situation that Isaiah is speaking into here is one in which, if Isaiah is writing at the time of the Assyrian invasion, and that's what I believe to be the case, he's writing to an audience where the people of Israel have suffered for a long period of time now, and they're going to suffer more before all is said and done. And what Isaiah is saying, or what God is saying here, is look at history. Look at all that has happened. Is it not the case that I predicted things long ago which have come to pass? And they could look at their history and reflect on promises made to Abraham and things that were said about, predicted about the Israelites being taken into captivity in Egypt. And then about them coming back, and about the land being given by God to Abraham. This was the land that they would live in. And they come in the conquest. But Moses predicted some things about the nature of Israelite society and the state when they moved into the land, that they would demand a king, and that they would be given a king, and that king would abuse his power and take advantage of them, and all those sorts of things. So there are a large number of predictions that were made and fulfilled prior to the time that we're talking about right now. And they can look back and see that that is the case. Furthermore, there are additional predictions that are being made now in the time of Isaiah. There'll be more that are made in the time of Jeremiah with respect to them being conquered by the Babylonians and taken into exile, and then returning from that exile. And they can look at those things as they unfold and see that God did indeed predict it, and it did indeed come to pass. And God is saying, I challenge any competitor to look at history and show us where they predicted what would happen, and then that they brought it about. And weave that all into a narrative that's coherent and makes sense. Like I can. Like I, as the God, as the creator and the master, the author of history, am able to do. Because whatever I purposed from the very beginning, I bring it about. That's because I am God. I think the relevance of this for us is significant. Much of the history that Isaiah is talking about is way back in the mists of time. When were the promises made to Abraham, and when were the promises made to Jacob and his sons? That was a long time ago. And those were fulfilled afterwards, if you believe that the Old Testament is accurate and was written back when tradition claims that it was written. So it's easy to find a way to discount those things as being not really proofs of God and his mastery over history. But I can't help but think that in the time in which we live, we have good evidence of God's mastery of history. That is to say, if you look at history, and you want to make sense of history and how it has come to be the way it is, One thing you have to make account for is, what about the Jews? Why are they still around? They're so hated. They're hated worldwide. They were almost wiped out, especially in the Holocaust. Huge numbers of them were killed. Huge proportion of them were killed. But they continued to exist. Why, over the years, have they suffered so much? Isaiah is giving an account for that. Why have they also been so blessed, in some ways so very fortunate? Isaiah is always also accounting for that. Why do they live in the land that God gave them, gave to Abraham and his descendants? How do you account for that? Is that not interesting? I have been reading over the last few years quite a bit about the history of the state of Israel. And the story of the founding of Israel is quite remarkable. And the impetus behind it was not by Jews who wanted to fulfill the promises that were given in the Old Testament. The driving forces behind it were secular. They didn't believe the Old Testament. They just wanted a place where Jews could live separate from the rest of the world because they were convinced that Jews can't mix with the rest of the world. And yet, they ended up in Palestine as a nation, even though it was not religiously motivated. And a lot of people contributed to that, not just Jews. And many of those who contributed, probably most of those who contributed, were secular rather than religious. However, some of them were religious. And right now I'm reading a book about the Six-Day War, which is an amazing event in which Israel was just given this little indefensible strip in Palestine. But then in the Six-Day War, because the Arab countries surrounding them were putting together armies to annihilate Israel, Israel struck back. Actually, they struck first because they did not think they could survive otherwise, and ended up taking possession of the land all the way to the Jordan and further south and further north. And in reading about that, it is amazing. I encourage you to read it. There's a book by Michael Oren. It's very interesting. It was a combination of ineptitude on the part of the Arabs, confusion on the part of the Arabs, misinformation that they gave to one another, and mistakes. And it's just a series of them, a whole series of them, that paved the way for Israel to take what they took. It's a remarkable story. How do you account for that? And Isaiah is saying, any of my competitors has to account for that. They have to be able to say, I knew it was coming, and I made it happen. And there has to be evidence that that's the case. And God is saying, there is no competitor that can do that. I'm the only one who can do that. Okay, I have a little time for questions. Questions or comments?
When you're talking about Cyrus and his proclamation that God told him to do this and so on, There was a strong Jewish community in Babylon, wasn't there?
There was.
Would he have any knowledge of this? And weren't they in the process of actually putting down oral stories and so on that became the Bible in Babylon? Wasn't this going on?
That's what some people claim, that it was being put into writing at that time. I think it may have existed in writing before that, but yes, there was a lot of activity in Babylon where they were studying and taking care of the texts of the Bible. And people have speculated as to whether Cyrus had access to that, would have known that. There are some Jewish accounts that say that he did, but there's some question as to whether those are reliable accounts. But it is certainly plausible that he could have, because that the Jews that were in Babylon would have retained those, would have had those stories. He could have learned them from them.
And then in the Six-Day War, wasn't that when Arabs would come to Jewish homes and say, oh, this will be a nice home when we... Was that during the Six-Day War?
I don't know.
Okay, I have read accounts where one of the wars, I don't know if it was Yom Kippur or Six-Day, they would have Arab neighbors come in and just say, oh, this house is going to be mine.
Yeah, I don't know. The Arabs were very confident going into it that they would be successful in defeating Israel, if not driving them out of the land.
Hey, David.
Mm-hmm.
We're listening to the song of praise that's in 42:10 through 17.
Mm-hmm.
It's attractive to me to read that as looking forward to the judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Especially 14 through 17. It sounds like it's talking about when God is going to finally make himself visible again in history and wipe the slate clean, and then that you have the image of these two separate groups of people, one that trusts in idols and that are going to be finally put to shame, and then a group of people who seem to be helpless if not for God's leading. And I wonder if the unfamiliar path along which I will guide them is kind of alluding to, you know, faith in Christ, this path that's unfamiliar now, but by mm-hmm. which I will bring these people through this time. So, mm-hmm. I don't know, I just wondered if you had any thoughts.
That's the way I'm inclined to take it, yes. Yeah, I think this is another one of those, the imagery is very physical, but the reality that's being pointed to is a spiritual reality, I think, all the way through this section. And Isaiah has done that periodically through the book. And in fact, as I mentioned last week, I'm reaching the place where I'm inclined to think that a much bigger part of Isaiah is pointing to the end of time than I had originally thought. And so I'm inclined to see it that way, yes, this passage that way.
So I was kind of wondering about that same thing, mm-hmm. verses 14 through 17. It had the feel of some of Revelations.
Yes.
And as I was sitting here thinking that, I was trying to figure out now, how do I figure out when it's that, when he indeed is really referring to for the end of times, mm-hmm. versus something more about their present day trappings.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I know that it's not simple, the answer,
right.
Or how to know that. But could you speak to that just a little bit?
Well, that's part of what I've been struggling with all the way through Isaiah, is how to sort that out. When is Isaiah talking about something that's going to happen in the near future, and when is he talking about something that happens at the very end of time? And I started out assuming that he was primarily talking about that near future. And as I worked from that hypothesis, I kept running into places where the language is too grand to really be appropriate for the phenomenon that happened in their close proximity in time. And so then I began to think, well, he's got to be talking about something. Oftentimes, there'll be some, the difference between it suggests it's worldwide, for instance. This phenomenon is worldwide. And what happens with the Assyrians or whatever is not worldwide. So what I've concluded is that Isaiah is primarily about the end of time, but it talks a lot about those events that come during the time of and soon after Isaiah. And those are kind of a dress rehearsal for the end. They bear a resemblance to the end, but it's not the full-blown thing. And so they're a picture of the end in a sense. They give us some idea of what's coming at the end, but they aren't ultimately what Isaiah is talking about. So I'm now convinced that much more of Isaiah is talking about the end than I used to think. And the thing that directs me, that steers me there, is the kind of grandiose language that's used.
Thanks, that's helpful.
Mm-hmm. Anything else? Okay, thanks.